Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Every day I'm moving further from sobriety. Further from sobriety. So sobriety.
And now it's time for Homegrown, your only show dedicated to local art, with your hosts David Von Strawn and Leslie M. Scott Jones. And now, here's David and Leslie.
Here we go.
Hello! Charlottesville!
Oh my god. Yes,
the
it is.
The first show of Homegrown, your show about local art. I am David Von Strawn, highly caffeinated, never duplicated, a.k.a. Nefarious Rucker, a.k.a. Negro Suave, a.k.a. Black Frodo, a.k.a. the Independent Variable. We don't put it all down.
That's a lot of a.k.a.s.
I
Deltas are going to get mad at you.
I mean, I have many challenges in my life.
Many chapters.
And with me as always, to start off this wonderful 2018, full of opportunity. I'm so happy. I'm so happy about this 2018.
Really?
Yes. New mayor.
I know, right?
New chief of police
Nakaya.
Coming up. Well, I wish the just police would disappear. We could just defend our own community, but that's
well, you know.
And just so many. And the beginnings, the seeds planted.
Yes.
To grow a brand new Charlottesville. I am stoked. I am so excited.
You
with
are.
Me, as always, is the lovely, the loquacious, the lascivious Leslie M. Scott Jones.
Well, good morning, David.
My POC.
You are
HBIC.
Like...
ready to put it all down. Tell me.
HBIC. I like that. I'm keeping that.
Are you keeping that?
I'm keeping
right,
that.
Yeah.
HBIC.
That's
so good.
Maybe I should just say that for the women, but I just thought.
No, that's
cool.
I was like that. No,
we're
seriously.
You realize
that was my nickname in high school.
I believe it. I truly believe it. How do you feel about 2018?
I am really good, actually. You know, I am with you. I think that 2018 is going to be really exciting in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different ways. You know, this we claiming it. That's what we're going to do. We claiming it. It's our year.
Yeah.
Damn
year
it.
Of the woman. Year of the woman. In so many ways, shape, and forms.
Well, you know, the world would just be better if they just let us run everything anyway.
And the world would be better if they also didn't choose delegates out of a hat with a film canister.
Well.
But that's another story here.
There
nor
is
there.
Always that.
What the hell was that about?
I don't know.
What, are we going to play Spin the Bottle next time?
Like,
for
who
our
thought that was a. Who
elected
that
official? And it's going to be Steve
and
in accounting.
You
run the district.
And now you two have to kiss. Sorry, it's just the way the game works. What? I don't know.
I mean, Trump's in office, so everything's out the window.
You know what? I think in 2018 we should stop using that person's proper name. Just,
that's a
know,
proper name.
Well, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Like, I just think we should just stop using.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It almost feels like a curse word at this point. Like,
right?
Yeah.
Yes.
You
maybe we should make it a curse word.
Get Trump out of here. What are you keeping? Oh, my
Lord. We're keeping it. We're keeping it.
Yes. We're going to make it a curse word. That's what we're doing.
That's right. I'm going to try not to Trump up the show. I'm going to keep it nice. I'm going to keep it fresh.
That could have so many meanings.
But politics aside, you tuned into Homegrown. You're right. This is your show about local art, and we have local artists.
Yes,
in the house. Deborah McLeod, she is back. She runs the Chroma Projects Art Lab. She is the gallery and exhibition director. Say hi, Deborah.
Hello.
Deborah's chilling in the back. Deborah's afraid of microphones. We don't bite. I swear to you, we don't bite.
Well, you know, unless you ask.
No, screw it up if you want. But she's featuring at the Chroma Projects Art Lab, Martha Saunders. She is a painter. She is currently running the exhibition Transmutations from now through the 27th. Check it out right there.
Yeah,
on our
that's pretty right there. That's
can we have our cameraman pan to the
See, I'm everything right now, right? Right? So I'm going live on my phone. Now I'm the cameraman.
That's right.
Like, am I getting demoted?
I was going to say, she's using up, you know, valuable data, you know, to make this happen. So.
Because I pay for my art, okay?
Props to Queen Bee for making it happen on the camera. Richard Knox Robinson, speaking of cameras, he's a filmmaker. He's got Orwell's Revolution, which already premiered at the gallery? ? Is what I have on my script.
Yeah.
Okay.
At the opening night, we had it in the back.
It in the back?
Yeah, we had it in the back room, set it up, and it went off without a hitch.
Okay. Great. Just that one showing?
Oh, we're going to run it throughout the whole the opening for the next month,
Nice. Mm-hmm. Nice. And this is going to be like a weekly event, like every Friday at blah, 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 or something, or just like random?
Just Saturday.
Yeah, every just Saturday, I guess, is what you're saying.
It's an hour long. So.
It's an hour.
Let's get all nice and cozy up in here.
Yes!
Yes.
Everybody come in.
Yeah, it's that cold. We all just need to huddle together. We actually need to start a fire in the studio.
We'll just break the table up and use the legs for firewood.
Right. Just like, what the Trump is going on in here?
Jeff, let's get some heat in this. Sorry. We're just cracking ourselves up this morning.
We've missed each other.
Well, I was saying... Richard's film is an hour long, so Saturday is the best time to come and see it because you have to give yourself a little time to watch it.
So how's that been? How's the opening of the new Chroma Projects Art Lab? Because the last time we talked, it was still like, you know, an evolution. It hadn't been up yet. Now it's up. Now it's going. You got lovely features going on. How's it working out for you?
Well, my space is wonderful. I'm in the Old Oasis Spa building, and it's beautiful, and I love it, but it's not permanent. I'm a floater.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. We can float. Yeah. We are all artists around here. We are nomadic. I still am on Gypsy Housing and Facebook, so anytime I need to bounce out, I can do so. And let's get that address again. So
it's 103 West Water Street.
103 West Water Street. So downtown, she will be there temporarily, but still fully functional, 100%.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful.
All right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of beautiful, I'm looking at this beautiful Transmutations painting right here. The texture is coming out from the monitor. It desperately looks.
So what's your definition of transmutations?
Well, the reason I picked that word was because it fit in a way the idea of painting itself as a process of things changing, and I hope the paintings feel alive in that sense, where they're suggest movement and change, and changing from different states of even maybe matter in a way. Mm-hmm.
It's based on a reading series.
I was going to say, what exactly inspired you to create this series?
Well, I started this series. I tend to work on, you know, a number of series at once and over many years. And this series started back in 2008. And I was kind of musing at that time about, in a way, the loss of language, even though I don't like saying that because, of course, I think people immediately, but the idea of a state of not having words. Hmm. And so I was also the idea of law. So I, at that time, was using press type and actual, you know, images of letters and a lot of collaging. And some of those works are in the show. I put three of those in. Mm-hmm. But the newer pieces really represent, the figure became the page. So that was kind of the metaphor in these pieces. Mm-hmm. But and the page is, it basically has things falling off of it, merging into it,
right,
solidifying. So those kinds of those ideas.
So what kind of color schemes are you using for that? Because, I mean, we have one... the one we have, it's a lot of blues, a little bit of orange, a little bit of yellow, but I can see, just as you're describing it, I can see that lending itself to all different kind of color schemes. How did you go about choosing that?
Well, some of these change, but they actually begin with some manipulation of actually printed information. So
right.
like in something like National Geographic that has particular, so the color schemes come from that some, although uh-huh. they do change. And I started a lot of these pieces with manipulating actual, as I said, photographic images and printed matter. And those were the kind of the sketches to begin with. But compositionally, colors change because of what I wanted to. I'm interested in the paintings kind of acting as a verb.
Yeah.
So if I want something, you know, to change in terms of its spatial relationships, obviously you have to change color
right.
and intensity because of that, to change those you know, features or those visual elements have to change to create that verb that I'm looking for.
And you use beeswax in some of these?
Yeah, all of them. And it's a medium that, when I said live service a little bit ago, I mean, that's one I've had a hard time letting go of the beeswax. I've been working for almost 15 or more years with it. And part of it is because it is a live surface, and people are aware of that.
Right.
Although sometimes I worry that people might not want to, it would be like buying a pet in a way. Not really. It's very stable. It can be stable. But I think they know that it can change.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It could melt down. Actually, they're very stable, though, and it's a very old method of painting.
Mm. Right.
It's called encaustic painting. But the beeswax... not only in my own process of being, you can collage easily with it, and also you can manipulate it constantly. And I laugh and say massage the paintings into being.
Oh,
way.
Yeah.
And it's funny that you say that because, like, using, like, live matter as a medium, because especially with this one, sorry to be so graphic, but it kind of looks like scabs. And it kind of has like this kind of like discoloration, like, you know, like it would on like human skin. So I like identify like a certain like amount of pain into that, like this one specifically. And it also looks like, you know, like the horizon of a cloud, like you can see like the line of the ocean and something like that. So, like I said, it's extremely textured, more so than other painters that have come in, like Lisa Bean's paintings were like extremely textured, like medium on top of medium
on top of medium, right? Yeah.
And you know, whereas like people use like more like computer graphics. So like, do you want to like, and I also wanted to like get your thoughts on the loss of language. I wanted to elaborate more on that because it's like, are you saying like a physiological like loss of language, like being unable
to
speak?
That's why I don't usually say it in those terms, because mm-hmm. I think we do think about that, obviously.
Or is it more like a cultural like losing of the vernacular that we kind of grew up with and were taught to
Maybe more of an invitation to that our mind would be used in a different way. You know, I think when you make things, when you're a maker, these days you really have to ask yourself, you know, why am I making more stuff? I think we all struggle with that as artists.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I think I've been really thinking a lot for a long time, but lately more clearly about the power of objects and our relationship with them, and that maybe there are not so many differences between live beings and objects, but I don't want to get into that a whole lot. But
let me see your
question about language. So I just think, you know, these paintings are very abstract,
mm-hmm.
and but they have a figurative base, and I like that you said body, because I do think the physicality, I'm kind of interested that... I think sculpture has really been the language of, I mean, I'm not the only one, of 20th century language. And I think people really want, seek physical experiences.
Right.
So I hope that the paintings can have that aspect to them, because they smell. And they also, that physicality that you're talking about, a lot of people, somebody even said to me recently they wanted to lick the paintings.
Whoa.
And I thought, okay, wow. That's a real, so maybe physical responses as opposed to verbal.
Wow.
Instead of going beyond identifying, because when we look at images, we try to identify. You did a bit of that.
Right.
I see a landscape, and mm-hmm. that's all fine. But I kind of hope to break into something more like how we accept music. I mean, that's a very old idea. Kandinsky thought about that a lot.
So how do you manipulate the wax? Obviously, it has to be
heated.
Warm when you
I have
use
a
it.
Heat gun and
do you just sculpt it with the gun in your fingers?
Well,
or?
You know, when you have a palette that's basically a heated palette, mm-hmm. so it's
stay.
But you know, if you wax, you put it on it, it dries immediately.
Yeah,
and so then then I manipulate with a heat gun and my own hand heat. I work in a place where I live too, a warehouse that has big eastern windows.
So right,
the light from the sun actually is something I use.
Keeps
too.
It malleable.
Mm-hmm.
Wow,
malleable's the word.
Do you condition
that's
it
cool.
with a lacquer, like to keep it like locked in, or do you just like hope that every art gallery is freezing like every art gallery I've been to and the beeswax
cold's the enemy. No, actually okay. Cold is the enemy.
Okay.
If it was hot enough for it to really melt, I've had some pieces in the past sweat. I don't think that's such a bad thing though. I kind of like that. But you know, you wouldn't be in the room if it was hot enough for it to
okay.
melt. You don't put it in the trunk of a car when it's 90 degrees, then you wouldn't have a painting.
Right.
But it's cold. Cold is actually
right because it gets brittle and it'll
separating the layers.
Right.
And encaustic right. that you use, there's a mixture a recipe that helps harden the wax that I use that uses Damar crystals.
Yeah, okay,
that is so cool.
Nice.
Anyway,
we gotta pay a bill or two. I think is it two today? I don't know. Yeah, we're talking about
two?
Beeswax. We're coming right back. This is Homegrown. Drop! It is 18 minutes past the hour, and if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Homegrown. WPVC 94.7. The person. We love that. The progressive
Thank
voice
you,
of
Bill.
Charlottesville. Deborah McLeod is in the house. She runs Chroma Projects Art Lab. We are talking to Martha Saunders about transmutations running now through January 27th. And soon we'll be with Richard Knox Robinson, who's showing Orwell's Revolution. That's going to be showing. Pretty Deborah says Saturday, so we're doing Saturdays because she runs that joint. All right. Saturday.
She's the grand poobah.
Yes. The grand poobah of the chroma. But I wanna get with Martha Saunders about one more question and we'll move it to you, Richard. But in the transmutation series and for every series like that you do, like how long on working on a painting is too long, or do you believe that you can like overdo something, you can fill up the page too much, anything like that? How long does something like this take to construct, and when do you feel good about like putting down the brush or the beeswax or whatever and stepping away from it and being like, okay, I'm done, good, let's run it?
Yeah, that's the mystery. And this is something, you know, that I can't. You just know there's some kind of you're convinced. For me, it might be that verb I'm looking for, I feel like, is taking form. And you just have to, you know, live with paintings for a long time. And, you know, you think you're finished and you walk away and you work on other ones. But you have it hanging around in your peripheral vision, and you start to notice things. And there's not really a clear answer to that. And that's kind of the mystery of making things when it ignites something. And I'm not saying that I always make things that do. And sometimes you send things out that you're a little unsure about, but I think if it ignites some ideas that you can stay with it for a long time, it's engaging. That usually is one of the signs.
Nice.
Well, I don't know about that. Yeah, it's nice when it happens, and it's rare. I mean, you know, a lot of times work doesn't work,
right?
But you work for that, and if you get what I should say, just if you get a little bit of a feeling of it,
and
that's enough.
And you work for that one person to ask to lick your paint. And then you fake a cell phone call. Exactly. It's like, oh my God, my hip is buzzing. No, I'm listening to everything that you have to say. Bye.
Excuse me, it's my mom. I have to take that.
Speaking of lying to the public, Orwell's Revolution.
You are Segway
King. Yes!
No, right?
Segway King.
It took a year. It's almost my year anniversary on Homegrown, actually.
That's right.
So it took me a while to build up the segues. But Richard Knox Robinson, he's up in the his house showing Orwell's Revolution. A film that has already premiered at the gallery. We'll be showing Saturdays consecutively, hopefully.
If the name doesn't tell us, what's the film about?
And that's a good question. It's hard to describe as a complex. It's an experimental documentary, but it focuses on Orwell's experiences in the Spanish Civil War. When there was an anarchist revolution during the Spanish Civil War, and Orwell got involved and fought in the Spanish Civil War. And so his experiences, it really is the foundation of 1984, is Orwell's experiences in the Spanish Civil War.
Wow. Okay. So yeah. I never knew he actually fought. Crazy.
Same here.
Yeah, he, like a lot of people, he was interested in, you know, Spain. They had the coup of Franco, and so a lot of progressives went to Spain to sort of help the cause of the Spanish government. And Orwell ended up getting involved in this militia called the PUM that, purely by chance, was very critical of Stalin at the time. And when Russia got involved in the conflict, Russia tried to destroy the PUM. And that's sort of where Orwell takes off, and that's where 1984 tends to come from.
Hmm. And that's kind of funny because of all the stuff that's going down in Spain right now.
Yeah.
with the police coming in and, like, dismantling voting booths so that people can't vote their way out of the Spanish, you know, the Spanish government. I think that's, you know, it, bookends.
Well, it does. It was a funny film to make because it's been reverberating with history. I started it when Edward Snowden had made his revelations, and then... And so I thought it was going to be about the NSA, but now with the elections in Spain, yeah, that's become very pertinent.
Because it's funny, because now when we say, like, Orwellian, we're not talking about a person that fought, you know, that a person that was an anarchist and he fought for, you know, people, you know, to not be, you know, entrenched and dominated by their government. When we talk about Orwellian, like, psychology, it speaks more of a totalitarian state. So how did that kind of, like, idea kind of get mangled?
Well, partly because of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Orwell was always a socialist, and he never stopped being a socialist. He was just against Stalin. And his book that he wrote about the Spanish Civil War, Homage to Catalonia, was largely ignored until the Cold War, and then it was brought out as sort of an anti-communist book, even though Orwell would have objected to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's how he got used. I mean, 1984 was very popular, but even Homage to Catalonia, he just sort of got taken into this anti-Russia thing that really wasn't his point. I mean, 1984, he specifically tries to not have it just be about Russia. He wants to make people realize that it can be about England as well.
So, that it can happen anywhere, right?
Right, that it can happen anywhere. Yeah, I mean, his experiences was with Stalin, but he saw it as possible also in England and America.
Well, and here we go, you know, art imitating life, imitating art.
Yes, you have to defend America and show peace by fire and fury.
Right, yeah. I'm
Makes
sorry,
total
what?
Sense.
So when you change the direction of the film from the NSA to Orwell, how did that change your creative process? Like, how did that shift what you were doing?
Well, I mean, part of the shift is just the way that people look at the film. You know, okay. the sort of meaning of the film changed as I was making it. I mean, I did go through a lot of evolutions in making it. I had to do a lot of research, and I had to kind of come to terms with what Orwell was saying and what his experience was. And the one thing I realized that Orwell is really you know, critiquing the documentary in this sort of media form. And, you know, with Facebook and stuff like that, it was also very pertinent because, you know, the idea of truth and media, he's critiquing that. I mean, his focus on, you know, the thought police, I kind of interpret as sort of the narrative police that is produced by media.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Speaking of, do you re-edit your film in any way, shape, or form when you, like, in the beginning, like when you started showing it and you started getting feedback from it and people were kind of like, well, I'm getting this from it. Did you ever, like, re-edit it and, like, show it in a different form? Because I, you know, I was interested in Leslie's question about creative process. And we'll actually get to, like, you know, the actual content of the film, like, soon. But, you know, just...
You're giving me this weird look, and it's like, what did I say?
Well, no, I mean, it's a big... I did try to release it at the beginning of this year, but I think I wasn't getting good feedback, and I'm kind of glad I pulled it back, because I was able to get this archival footage.
And I didn't know that. This is the first time I've heard about this.
Well, and I got some archival footage from Ukraine, some Russian propaganda footage that I put into the film. And it was really quite amazing. You can really see propaganda much more clearly when you're looking at another country's propaganda.
Right.
And looking at Russia's propaganda. Mm-hmm. And it fit really well.
And other countries looking at our propaganda.
Right, I know. Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. My Russian friends and my, you know, my Soviet bloc friends can see our propaganda very clearly.
Mm-hmm. Whereas we're just like, oh, that's just a sitcom. But it's like, it has a narrative, washing your brain as we speak.
Well,
enjoy Young Sheldon. Yeah. Enjoy.
Enjoy. Enjoy. Soak it all in.
Yeah. CBS is a devil. I'm sorry. I
couldn't. Wow. No. I had a Russian, you know, when Trump was elected, a friend of mine from Russia was in town. And I said, I can't watch the news anymore. And he goes, in Russia, we have a word for that. We call that internal exile.
Oh, nice.
Wow.
I've done that to a few people in my life, actually.
That's just awesome. Like,
I know. That's what I feel.
But. So the film is... So there's actual propaganda footage in it. How is the film structured? Like, what is actually, when people go to see it, what will they see?
It tries to answer two questions. You know, when I started doing the film, I was curious why Orwell's account of the Spanish Civil War is largely ignored by most people. Mm. You know, the historians don't really, not all of them, except for Noam Chomsky. And then the other question was, my conceit was, you know, why do...
Can I just say really, really quickly that I think when I look back at my own history education, that one of the really, really important things that was treated the least, that was undertaught, was the Spanish Civil War.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. No, it's Orwell's version of it even less, you know, because usually you get the international brigades, but the international brigades was largely supported by Russia, and so they had some issues, and was very different than the PUM, which was the militia that Orwell was involved in. But the other question I wanted to answer in the film was, why are documentary films made this way? You know, why do they use the same images? Why do they repeat these themes? Why do they seem to be motivating us instead of informing us?
Right.
And I ended up using a classic documentary film that was made during the Spanish Civil War called The Spanish Earth is sort of my counterpoint. And
okay.
So it's complicated, but it's, you know, and those are the two questions. And I found Noam Chomsky is supporting Orwell's account of the Spanish Civil War. And so I interviewed him, and then...
I'm sorry, what? You interviewed him?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's amazing. What? Holy crap. Wait.
Yeah.
Wait.
I was like, what? Wait,
hold on.
What?
And he just, like, threw that in there like it was nothing.
Yeah, it was at Noam's house.
You know.
Kicking it.
Noam's house. Talk to him.
You know.
You know, like you do.
Yeah.
Hold
anyway,
on.
These tacos are delicious.
What was it like to actually sit and talk with him? That's amazing.
It was very intimidating. I mean, you're trying to do your prep for the interview. I mean, he's written so much. You're just like, oh, my God. But he actually was quite nice. He was wonderful. I mean, it was a very pleasant experience. Mm-hmm. I really just asked him three questions and let him go off, and he, you know, he gave a lot of wonderful stories about the Spanish Civil War. It's interesting because I was studying the Spanish Civil War and I realized that, you know, this is the beginning of Noam Chomsky's political identity as the Spanish Civil War. Mm. And so that's why I asked him if he'd let me interview him.
Why do you think that the Spanish Civil War is so under educated and undertaught and underreported? Like, what is, because I Louisa County High School, I know nothing about the Spanish Civil War. So it's like, I mean, could you maybe clue me in on why?
Or why you think,
Things aren't historically reported because it's either controversial or it's very layered or it's multi-layered or there's no one clear side. There was a bad guy killing Jewish people called the Holocaust. We had to go and fight him. Bad people killing good people, killing bad people. The end. Mm-hmm. Spanish Civil War, I think, was a little bit more nuanced than that.
Yeah. I agree. And I mean, and Noam Chomsky says it, and he says it in the film, is that it's the anarchist revolution. Because, you know, when Franco staged his coup, everybody thought Spain would fall immediately, the government would fall. But the anarchists became very engaged and actually raided the armory and armed all the peasants. And they started getting involved in fighting off Franco. And it was the anarchist revolution that the West didn't like. It's one of the reasons they didn't get involved. And also Russia had its issues with, too, because Russia wanted to be the center of the revolution.
Mm.
And they didn't want to be upstaged by the revolution in Spain.
Wow.
That's so funny. No, so we're fighting harder.
Like,
the cool kids are at our revolution.
Seriously? Do you know how big Russia is? Like, right? You're worried about Spain?
Yeah, at that time, they were like the USSR.
I mean,
don't be stealing our thunder over there.
Ego. That's fine. Wow.
Just make some almonds and send them over.
Well, I mean,
and let us do our thing.
You had the show trials going on in Russia at that time, and Stalin's starting to kill all the Bolsheviks. You know,
yeah.
Basically, by the time he's done, he's the only one left.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't, so maybe they should have gotten more attention.
Wow.
Well, Orwell's Revolution, Spanish Civil War, Noah Chomsky. I thought it was going to be a whole bunch of animals talking, but I'm happy that it's going to be something completely Animal Farm. Well,
I know Animal Farm,
I went there. Yeah. Richard Knox Robinson,
right.
Martha Saunders, Deborah McLeod, thank you so much coming out to Chroma on Saturday nights to get my transmutations in Orwell's Revolution on. No, I really want to see this. This is actually like...
Seriously, we need to go Saturday,
it's
David.
It's like 10 times. Yes, Saturday.
Can we say it's a date?
Saturday! Yes. All right, now through January 27th, transmutations and Orwell's Revolution running until Deborah McLeod says it can't run anymore. So we're going to do a draw. We're just going to keep going.
We're
going
to go
doing
right
this
into
for
the
a year.
He's been doing it for a year
gotten
it yet.
I can't hear the music. Here are some of the artistic events happening this week. Currently, through January 19th, Drawn to Charlottesville, a group show of 12 local artists being shown at Second Street Gallery. And also now running through January 16th is the Kluge Rui Aboriginal Art Collection. Rui, yeah, I'm just making... Rui, I know, I'm just making... Yeah, it's been a while. Aboriginal Art Collection presents an off-site exhibition defending the ocean. 21 works by contemporary indigenous artists celebrating the central importance of the ocean to human life at the Charles L. Brown Science and Engineering Library in UVA's Clark Hall. And today, Stanton's Shenanigans is holding auditions for We Will Rock You, the musical by Queen, from 2 p.m. to 7 p.m. Also today, Monticello High School student play A King's Story tells through hip-hop narrative a fictional story about a young black teen killed by a white police officer on August 12th in Charlottesville. Mm. The play plays at Live Arts Theater.
Fictional?
Today.
Mm. Fictional?
Look, see, I wasn't going to say nothing. January 13th. Our Streets, a documentary, quotations, about a documentary about August 12th at the Jefferson School African American Heritage Center. Two showings, one at 5 p.m. and one at 8 p.m. And for your music options this week,
oh my goodness, Music this week.
Music this week.
Today, Berto Sales and Miles Pierce bring their Latin guitar duo city to Glasshouse Winery at 2 p.m. Benny Dodd at James River Brewing. You did that to me. Yes, you gave it to me. James River Brewery at 4 p.m. tonight, Three Notch Road, the Charlottesville Baroque Ensemble plays a concert called Bach, Bieber, and Pachelbel.
Is that Bach Bieber and Pachelbel?
No, it's not Bieber. Oh, okay. No, it's not Bieber. Okay. It's Bieber. Sure. B-I. Okay. Bieber. Okay. Instrumental Sonatas of Germany at the First Presbyterian Church. Also tonight, Travis Elliott at Rapture. Tomorrow, ATM unit featuring Jonah Kane West at Rapture.
Kane West? What?
Kane West.
I'm sorry.
David?
I'll be good.
Could you take
I'm
a seat,
here.
Please?
I'm over here.
Thank you.
I'm over here.
January 10th, Timeless Generation at Dirty Nelly's. Also on the 10th, alternative rock and jazz trio Yonderphonics. Why are you staring at me? You just want to stare at me? You can stare at me. January 11th, local string band The Unbelievers at the Whiskey Jar. Nick and Steve Pollock at Dirty Nelly's. Michael Ellsworth gathering at Fellini's. January 12th, multi-genre trio from Nelson County. Orme Storm at Wild Wolf Brewery. Folk punk revivalist The Can Do Attitude. That's a good name. With the Weird Mob and Bigsby at the Anteroom. Giz Carter and Juke Jackson at Dirty Nelly's. January 13th, traditional Indian painting workshop with Murad Khan Montaz at Second Street Gallery. Will Overman with Matthew McAllister at the Anteroom. Midlife Crisis Band at James River Brewery. The Pollocks at the Batesville Market. Aaron at the Wildfire at the Star Hill Brewery Tap Room. Mojo Pie at Dirty Nelly's. Oh my God. Every Friday morning, the West African Drum Circle at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Bluegrass Jam at the Front Porch Roots Music School. Seafoot, Charlottesville Friends of Old Time Music. Weekly Open Jam at Thomas Jefferson Memorial Unitarian Church. Songwriter Night at the Local. Every Tuesday, the traditional session at the Tin Whistle Irish Pub. Latin Guitar Night with Miles Pierce and Humberto Sales at the Bebedero. And everywhere. Wednesday.
Oh, snap.
Open mic night at Pro Ray, Not a Farm Brewery.
Bam!
Open mic night at Holly's Deli Pub, hosted by Josh Mayo.
Bam!
Jazz Collective number 9 at Fellini's number 9.
Bam!
But Shot of Fusion at the Anteroom, presented by the Charlottesville Salsa Club.
Bam!
DJ and friends at the Bebedero.
Bam!
And the Mike Krasinski and Jeff Jugger Quartel at Miller's.
What?
Every Thursday, Lua at the Bebedero. And every Thursday. John Durth at Miller's. All right. Oh, my God.
We're going to pay some bills. We're going to be right back. This is
drop.
Homegrown Drop.
Hello, this is Brian Weimer of the Ix Art Park, and you're listening to Homegrown, 94.7 WPVC.
Right, am I close enough?
All right.
Oh, yay, we're back. If you're just tuning in. Oh, no, I'm getting to it.
He's getting to it.
Oh, my God.
He's 38
minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, you have missed one hell of a half of Homegrown on 94.7 WPVZ, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. This is your show about local arts. Stay tuned after the show for the Sunday morning wake-up call with your host, Dan Gould, looking at three past guests from 2017. Those guests are Kareem Janea about being
Janina.
I forgot the neen.
Did you? He forgot the.
There was another.
Oh my God!
It's still early, y'all.
Oh my God!
Kareem Janina about being a Charlottesville Muslim. Brian Cannon about ending gerrymandering. And the Kaya Walker about August 12th. I'm sure she's got some stuff. I'm sure everybody got some stuff
Lord.
To say.
Yeah, she got some stuff.
Sounds like a good recap.
She got some stuff to say.
Sounds like some good recap. She's going to be saying some stuff, too. All right. But now, we don't do this a lot at Homegrown.
The amazing.
But we got a dance.
The talented.
Up in house. Joy Raymond is here. She is a co-member, of Fire in the Belly. She teaches belly dance lessons starting January 13th at the Dance Spot. Joy, thank you so much.
Good morning.
Good morning to you. Coming in the Homegrown.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be back.
Thanks for coming out in the cold.
Belly dancing.
Are you
belly
wearing three dancing. Scarves?
No.
Or is it just a multicolored
those,
scarf?
Like, it's one of those infinity scarves that just keep going. It just wraps around. Yeah.
I was going to say it's the weather for it, so I'm not knocking you. But yeah.
So it's been a while since you've been on the show.
Yeah.
But I've been keeping up with you on Facebook, your events and your classes, and a couple of videos. You doing your thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, doing your thing. I've always wanted to do belly dancing, but I don't know.
Come to my class.
I don't know.
All levels welcome.
You said it 2 years ago.
I know.
That's right.
I know. I said
Beth,
2 years ago.
I'm still
ago.
Waiting
you
for
know
you.
What? They're like, the outfits are really skimpy.
I'm going to let you dig your hole.
You don't have to wear those saying. Outfits in my class.
Okay. All right. All right.
I expect you there on the 13th.
Okay. All right. All right. If I show up, we're going to have to take pictures. We're going to have to post it on the homegrown page.
And prove
the whole deal.
That it happened.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
As David always says, pictures or it didn't happen.
Right.
I've just been starting saying that.
All right. So, how long did it take you to learn belly dancing?
I'm still learning. I've been doing it for, I think I started like 31 years ago.
That's amazing.
And I'm still learning, always learning.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. It's a never ending thing. Yeah.
What do you like about it? Why do you like it? What does it do for you? That form of dance.
It makes me happy.
Of course, dancing makes you happy. But that form of dance particularly.
Yeah.
As opposed to like,
I
other
think
dances.
It's the music that got me first. And hearing music from that area, it made me want to move to it.
Yeah.
You know? So, I think that's the I think the music is key. And then... just once I started doing it, I couldn't stop, and you know, yeah. And the community too. The community of belly dancers is really, really great. It's
talk about that. How is that different from any other community?
I guess it isn't. You know, it's just. It just has a tight knit community. I mean, there's a great one here in Virginia. I have a lot of really awesome friends that do belly dance, and I'm just really happy to be part of the community, and yeah, absolutely.
Yes. She's so, like, I can't mention names on there.
No. So I guess most people, when they think of belly dancing, they think of like what they see in a movie, right? So they always picture, you know, the dancers that, you know, that are performing for the sheik, you know, and
I think that's changing though. Yeah, I mean, especially with YouTube, you can see so many different styles, and so many, and men do it too. So
yeah,
let me make
that
clear.
I just found that out like last year that there are male belly dancers.
I have some really awesome, amazing male belly dance friends, and you've got, I mean, just go to YouTube and you'll see. I mean, yeah.
It's so how is that different? How is that different from what women do? Like,
it doesn't.
Really?
Not really, no. They learn the same moves.
That's
absolutely.
Cool.
Absolutely. Yes. Yes. So.
Okay, now I'm really interested.
Yeah.
So that's really interesting for me because a friend of mine who danced would frequently talk about how the dancing was good preparation for developing the muscles for childbirth.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I'm sure that's true. Yeah. I mean, developing any of the muscles there is great, I'm sure. But, I mean, I don't know if that's... I mean, it's an art form. Some people think of it as... that's part of its history, and I guess that is, but I don't know if that's proven, like women in the desert, they belly dance so they can get their muscles strong. So it's like, I don't think that's what it was meant for. It's not like this, you know, I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm sure, definitely, it would help. Anything that develops the muscles would definitely help.
Yeah, because, you know.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
I can't speak for myself because I don't have any kids, so I can't really. That's a subject I can't really.
Having pushed two of them out, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. Yeah. All right, then.
Yeah. Awesome. That would help. Yeah.
But if you did have a kid, it would just shoot across the room.
Hey.
I would hope so. I hope somebody would catch it.
Oh. Hopefully the doctor would be ready.
I'm so juvenile.
I'm sorry. I just got a mental picture of a doctor yelling, "Go!"
Scrubs and all.
We're just wrong today.
And on that note, we're gonna come back with Joyman. We're gonna do a drop. I'm gonna look up some male belly dancers and be completely jealous of their abs.
Oh my gosh, homegrown.
Yeah. Drop. And we're back. I'm gonna let Leslie see it.
Sorry.
47 minutes past the hour. If you're just tuning in, we're watching belly dancing on Homegrown. Your show about local art. We're here with Joy Raymond.
God.
She's a belly dancer. She teaches belly dancing. She has belly dance lessons. That's going down on January 13th at the Dance Spot. And she's... You can ask many questions. It's your show.
I don't know. Can you ask?
Essentially.
Ha, ha, ha. So what's the biggest challenge you think that people encounter in taking belly dance?
That's a great question. I think people don't realize how challenging it can be to learn. I think a lot of people want that instant gratification and they want to learn how to do something right away. And it takes a lot of time to
challenging physically or conceptually?
In both ways, but I think physically, just like learning what muscles to use to make the movements that you desire.
Looks like a lot of isolations.
A lot of the movements are small, so it differs from a lot of other dance forms because the movements are really small and internal. Especially for like the fast movements. But it takes a long time to learn, and I think you have to be kind of committed to it, so it takes a lot of time. You know,
yeah, like any art form,
like
and
any
anything
art form.
That you want to. Yeah, it's not absolutely. Like yoga. You can like come in and like do a few poses, and then walk out feeling better about yourself.
Right.
Like it's something that you really have to like, you know,
you
challenge
have to be prepared for like, you know, maybe not being happy with the way you do it at first.
Yeah,
it takes time, you know, but it also. It's not like that for everyone. I mean, and so these classes that I'm teaching, I'm only teaching them once a month.
Okay.
And it's open to people from any level. You know, they don't have to have experience. And I'm actually teaching like a little choreography. And each month it's a different choreography. And I'm not really a stickler for technique. I kind of teach the technique along with the choreography.
Mm-hmm.
So, and each month it's going to be something different, a completely different flavor to it. It might be a different style. So, yeah.
So I don't know any other way to put it. Is there a spiritual side to belly dance? Because I've talked to people who've belly danced and they talk about it differently than I've had other dancers talk about dance. There's a way they just get something in their eyes and their face. They're like, oh
yeah,
belly dance.
And the way you were describing it, you talk about community and you talk about like, you know, connection and togetherness. So there has to be something deeper to this than, you know, like a hip hop group that does like Step Up, you know, like every weekend or so.
Really?
I'm not trying to knock like different dance versions, but it's like, you know, it sounds like you personally have a deep investment with the people that you do this craft with.
I think for me it is a very healing art form, and I think at times it was like all I felt like I had. But as far as it being spiritual more than any other art form, I don't personally think it's any different from any other dance.
Right.
I think anytime you express yourself physically, yeah, there's going to be like this connection you feel. But I don't necessarily think belly dance is any different from any other dance form as far as spiritual or, you know, I'm not really, I mean, I guess I am personally a spiritual person, but I'm not, I don't really incorporate, like, I mean, some people talk about like the goddess energy and I'm like, whatever, you know, like, sorry, I'm not really, I'm not really that. So yeah.
I'm trying to get.
No, I mean it's fine. That's like I'm just not. I'm just all about and the art form and technique and the music.
And I think it's all about what you put into your art. And it's like going to the gym. Like a lot of people are gym rats, and like they go to the gym and they do it for like 4 hours, and they come out and they feel better about themselves, and they do it every single day. Like oof. And that's and they might feel like this kind of like spiritual, like, you know, enlightenment at some point where you get into like the zone and like everything like opens up like mentally and you're just like free from everything else that was going on in the rest of your life. So right. I can see that happening for anything that you just put your 100% of your mind powers.
Absolutely. Yes.
So is belly dancing like hula in that the different choreographies tell different stories or have different meanings?
I mean, I'm sure they can. Some of the movements are similar. Some of the hip circles can be similar to Polynesian dance, although they do it really crazy fast.
Yeah, yeah.
But I don't think, like, the hand movements, you can make them tell a story, I believe, but I don't think in them in and of themselves, you know.
Don't have like...
I mean, certain things. It depends on what culture you're... I mean, like... I do kind of like fusion belly dance, so I kind of mix up all kinds of different styles into, and it's like American modern fusion belly dance. But I love classical belly dance, you know, like the classic, because I love that Turkish music. Sure. I like Egyptian mostly. I love the classical Egyptian music, so it's just, I don't know. It does something to me. So, and awesome. So, yeah. So I love the classic style of belly dance, but there's so many different styles now. It's, you know.
So, so we're going to have to wrap up, but I have one question. January 13th, what style of choreography are you going to be teaching when people walk in?
I think I might do something a little slower, like a taksim, which is usually like a slow piece of music where like one instrument is being focused on, like, and maybe something slower. And, yeah.
Right on.
But each month I do something different, so it just depends on what I'm listening to at the time that kind of sparks something where I'm like, oh, I got to choreograph something to this. So, yeah.
If you ever want to collaborate at any point, I am an expert in the Cabbage Patch. So if you ever want to put,
David,
you know, do a...
David.
What?
David.
We can't...
David.
And we could do a David, humorous...
Right. All right,
theatrical.
Oh,
Lord.
Joy Raymond, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming to the show.
Great to be here.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'll be back. You'll be
cool.
Back.
Cool. I'd love to.
When you're
I'd
doing your belly dance show.
All right.
At the bridge or something like that. Push, push, hint, hint, wink, wink. Nudge, nudge.
Okay, sure. I'd love to.
Don't tell me what to do.
No, no. Sure.
I love it. You're just like, yeah, sure. Whatever.
We'll just talk to Alan and say, hey, Alan, you need to join.
Yes. Y'all need to do something.
Sure.
That's what we do. That's what we do.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We put people together. We make things happen.
Awesome.
Here at Homegrown.
Love that.
And now for Leslie's weekly rant.
Oh, my goodness. All right, so how many of you remember that crap movie that came out a few years ago with Brad Pitt, Troy?
Which one? Oh.
Right, I know. There's so many.
World War Z?
Yeah, I don't want to remember it came out either, but because the cast of this movie looks like they took the city of Troy and moved it to Wisconsin. You know what I'm saying? Like, it was so lily white, okay? It made absolutely no sense. So now everybody got their panties in a twist because the BBC and Netflix have made a TV series called Troy, The Fall of a City. Y'all, ooh, you need to go to IMDb and look at this cast.
I'm going through it right now.
This cast actually looks like people who live in or came from the Mediterranean. Okay. This cast, woo, Lord Jesus. This cast has brown hair. This cast has beautiful brown skin, ladies and gentlemen. And can I just say that the fun as frog's hair brother, Hakeem K. Kasim, playing Zeus, is a dream come true. A black man is also playing Achilles. Yes. And there are many other actors, obviously, from the Mediterranean or from African descent in the cast. Okay. Now, I know y'all people look at Greece, Grecians, as if they are Caucasian. However, y'all, do me a favor. Look up a map. I want you to look where the Mediterranean Sea is and where Egypt is.
They kind of close.
No, no. Really, I'll wait. No. I'll wait. Google. Yeah. Mediterranean has two R's. Yeah. Now, I just want to be logical about this for a moment. You see how close Greece and Egypt are, right? And you want me to believe that Romans conquered basically all of Europe, but they were the only ones willing to go long distances to settle new land. That's what you want me to believe. You really want us to believe that there were no black people in Greece?
Not the musical.
You know, I'm young. I know I look young. You know, black don't crack. I wasn't born yesterday. You know what I'm saying? People from the Mediterranean have olive skin. They have dark hair. They have brown eyes. I know y'all like Brad Pitt. But he don't look like he came from the Mediterranean. I'm sorry. And I, for one, am super excited about this series. Okay? Now, there have been scholars. There have been scholars that have questioned this, saying that, no, there couldn't have been any black people in Greece. No, no, of course not. And there have been other articles written about this by Afrocentric historians. Yeah, they didn't mean that in a good way, by the way. Saying that, oh, you know, they take the look that everything came from Africa, so, you know, there had to be black people in Greece. Well, guess what? Everything did come from Africa. That's where we started. Okay? So, yeah, there were, number one. And number two, have you seen a picture of people in the Mediterranean? Like, they don't look like they came from Wisconsin. They ain't got blonde hair and blue eyes. What? Really? Really? I'm so through with these people. But anyway, I just wanted y'all to know about this series. It's called Troy, the Fall of a City. Okay. And, so it's done by the BBC and Netflix, and I plan on watching every episode. You hear me? And y'all that think that we're no black people in Greece, you can take your little white tears and have two seats. Thank you.
Now, really? Greece?
Right?
Greece? I mean, that's your rant? That's what you're doing?
I just got so upset.
My big, like, fat Greek whining?
They were so upset about a black man playing Achilles that I just couldn't. I just had to go in. I'm sorry.
Black man can't be that strong.
Right? A black man can't be invincible. What are you talking about?
We actually got some time. We'd like to thank our guests, Devin McLeod, Martha Saunders, Richard Knox Robinson, Joy Raymond. Coming up next, Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call with your host, Dan Gould, looking at three past guests from 2017. These guests are Kareem, Janina, about being a Sarsville musician. Muslim. Jesus. I'm so sorry, Kareem. I'm so sorry. I'm going to get it right.
Wow. You didn't have coffee this morning,
I was going to say, I'm going to get you a tea, Kareem. I'm going to make this up. Brian Cannon about ending gerrymandering. And Mayor Nakia Walker about the events of August 12th. Stay tuned. This is Homegrown. We love y'all. Next week, I'm back. So get used to this face. Get used to this voice. Oh, my God. 2018 is going to be a mofo. It's going to be crazy. I love y'all. I love you, Leslie. I love you, Clinton. Take it easy, y'all. Next Sunday. Peace.
Listening to Homegrown on 94.7 WPVC LP Charlottesville. You can contact the show on Facebook by searching Homegrown Charlottesville.